Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. Now back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
And we're back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. I am Carrie Weber, along with Father Matt Malone, and we are talking with Gerald Schlabach about his recent article in America about the glamour of evil. We're not promising we're going to solve the problem of evil today, but if you want to call in, if you have a solution, or if you have a question for Dr. Schlabach, you can give us a call at 1-888-3-CATHOLIC. It's 1-888-322. 8465. So, Dr. Schlabach, I wonder, you know, you write a little bit in the piece about the perception that sometimes that evil, if maybe not calling it evil, but like the sinner is more fun than the saint. Or if we, you know, go with Billy Joel, you know, I'd rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints. Sinners are
right.
Much more fun. And is that part of that idea of the glamour and why, you know, why do you think that perception continues? And or is it true? Are sinners actually way more?
Yeah. Well, if the good doesn't need to advertise itself in the same way, you know, because it's authentic, there may be times when it does. It should, you know, we should be sharing the gospel and making it attractive and so on. But if we're doing that out of a place of authenticity, We don't need glamour in the same way, which means that the good, the authentic life is often self-effacing in a way. It doesn't, and I refer to the challenge in literature, why we have so many more, you know, crime novels than we have virtue novels, if there is such a thing, even. But, you know, for me, I face that in the classroom where I, you know, teaching ethics, trying to give students some guidance on how to live a fulfilling life. And, you know, it's so much easier to take on the hard cases, the issues at the edge for us as ethicists, than it is to talk about some of the basics or to communicate. So that was a little bit of the challenge that's even sort of driven this writing. Don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I've had to think about it.
Sure. And one of the things that struck me in the piece is this notion that one of the ways that evil is sometimes or can be glamorized or manifests itself as glamour, not always, is in this attraction that we have to fame, right?
Right.
And
right.
You say in the piece that fame is not known as a condition that makes it easier for people to be better, kinder, or more compassionate human beings. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, then that is a statement that is deeply countercultural, because we seemed, certainly in our popular culture, to highly value fame. And there's a way in which we all get excited when we're crossing the street and we see somebody famous, right?
Right.
And that we might desire that for ourselves. So how do you understand that?
Well, you know, someone could be accidentally famous because they've lived a good life. So that's where I'm saying because they've done something that's worthy of notice. So again, it's not fame that's the problem, but it's looking for the fame, it's celebrating the celebrity for the surface quality without the integrity behind it. That is what concerns me and what I think is misleading. And I say there, you know, all of us would like to meet a celebrity, you know, our favorite celebrities. Would we want them as our close friends? You know, go to a party, sure. Enjoy a few of the perks of their fame, sure. But are they necessarily the kind of people that are going to hang in there with us and over time? So that's where, again, I don't want to say that no celebrities are good people by any means. That just because one becomes famous, one has yielded to temptation. I'm simply asking, well, let's look a little deeper. Let's value what really is worthy of notice.
Right. I would imagine that being famous would sometimes, at least, make it more difficult to be good, because you would, once you have that sense of fame or the perks that come with that, you want to hold on to that. And then you have to sort of shape yourself to who, I guess, your fans or your public think that you are, instead of necessarily being able to go down a road that feels most authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in a way, I'm trying to give a different language for, you know, a longstanding teaching in Catholic moral theology that draws on Aristotle and a distinction between internal goods and external goods. You know, you can internal good. A baseball player can only be a really good baseball player in one, you know, by perfecting the practices of baseball. But then if you become a high-paid baseball player, well, you know, that money can be exchanged for anything else. You know, the money that a great tennis player earns. But they've got different, so that the internal skills can only, internal goods are always intrinsic to the practice themselves. But then once you start earning an external reward, then you may lose sight of how you got there, and you may lose sight of the very value. You may get caught up in, you know, in what those external goods can exchange for something else. I don't know if that's the quick lecture from the moral theologian, but
and it can happen in more modest ways too. Like
I
have a friend of mine who is an attorney, and he went to law school mainly because he wanted to represent poor and powerless constituents in the legal system. And what he found over time was he found himself kind of trapped and structurally, because he had accumulated all of this debt and he had to work at a big firm in order to pay off all of that debt. But then, you know, even once it was paid off, it was very hard to say, you know, I'm now going to give that up and, you know, go do what it is that I really wanted to do in the first place, right? In other words, he found it very difficult because of all of the stuff and the structures of stuff in his life to cultivate that initial vocational impulse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can happen to a lot of us, can it?
And you're scaring me a little bit. My oldest son is a Stanford trade lawyer, so who's just getting started in his career.
Okay, well, it's not him. Right.
So,
but I think
it can happen. It can happen to anyone. I mean, it happens in the academy. People go in for to bring it closer to home. You know, people love their field and so on, and then, but then you get caught up in the kind of competitive atmosphere that's even in the academy, where people love ideas and books and so on. But we get caught up in it.
Right. And it obviously happens in the priesthood too, right? We call that clericalism. But how do we counter that in our lives? How do we counter that as individuals and as a community?
Now I have to have the magic formula. Well, the church gives us a chance every year at Lent. Here we are on Ash Wednesday to examine what really matters most. That's a start. I've started suggesting that we use the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer, as a kind of a checklist of how does God reverse our expectations.
Well, I know for me,
there's talking a lot of attention lately in the culture to mindfulness. Mm-hmm. However, whether you practice meditation or something, being present with you know, my students if they come in for an come into my office, the classroom, with my family, my locale. Yeah, well, some of us will be called to move to different places to practice our vocation, but
it's about remaining grounded.
Let's make sure that we first are paying attention to the needs, the resources, the cultural, the things to celebrate in our own, where we are already, without always just notice that how often we're attracted to something else, someplace else. Always thinking the good life is elsewhere.
Well, I think one of the things that struck me, Father Malone, about what you, your friend's story is this idea of, in the sense, it's a lot harder to give something up. If you don't have it and you refrain from obtaining it, it's a little easier to kind of go through your life and be like, well, this is my life and I'm doing okay. And,
right.
You know, and I think of this in the context of my husband and I are currently looking for a house. We have some very small one bedroom apartment and we have a kid on the way. So we think, all right, we need a little bit more room than having the baby live in the living room forever. And so we're looking at a house, but we're looking at in places where some of the houses we've seen are very large. Some are small. Some are essentially the same size as our apartment, but like with a yard and a roof, you know, and some would require us then to buy much more stuff to fill it up. You know, it's like, oh, look at all this space. This is great. We'll be able to get this and this and this and this and this. And it's the idea of filling that up. But then that question of then maintaining that, then, you know, is there a sense that we will then continue to have to buy larger and larger houses because of all the stuff that accumulates, and suddenly we just fill the space that we have, like a goldfish grows to fill that kind of bowl. And if we deliberately choose to buy like a home that is smaller and that sort of, you know, can fit three people a little bit better, but not necessarily the stuff of 3 million people, hopefully that will keep us from trying to get more of that stuff, from the appeal of all those sparkly things that we think that we need, that when we have this dream of when we have a house, finally we can have, you know, X, Y, and Z, when really we're perfectly happy without X, Y, and Z right now. And so it's a question of then once you have it, that sense of like, well, you know, it's really nice to have this. It's a lot easier to have it than it was to not have it. And then having to kind of give that up, it makes it a difficult struggle. But Dr. Schlaubach, of what you were saying about that going out from your own home and the sense of that sometimes that glamour lies in that act of going out. And this mm-hmm. ties into your Benedictine spirituality of, I think a lot of times we associate stability or staying in one place as like a lack of progress, as almost a negative mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas within the Benedictine spirituality, it's a very positive thing. And I wonder if you can kind of talk about that contrast between that vow of stability and that sense of the next best thing being just on the other side of the hill.
You were talking about your own your husband and you looking for a home, and so I mean, in those of us who are married, and you know, really making a commitment to another person and for life, and saying, you know, I'm not going to keep my options open. One of the other lures is we're learning more from certain new school of psychology, more positive psychology, about what's called the paradox of choice, that we think we'll be happier if we have lots of options.
Right.
And yet psychologists are telling us actually not, that having fewer options teaches us to be satisfied with what we have. And so in a sense, that's what I think the Benedictines have known all along, is that, a baby monk will go in, a novice, and, you know, have all these illusions of the, you know, what this great life is going to be. And one of the first things they do is, you know, teach them some of the limitations to test whether they're going to hang in there. And the idea is, okay, you're going to stay with the same group of human beings over time. You're going to start to irritate each other, you know, as we do in marriage also. You know, we start to learn what the... But we need to tell stories to our children, to our young people, of the exquisite joys that are on the other side of just hanging in there a while,
right,
with each other. Even when, you know, even when we're starting to get sick of each other, even when we're, well, I won't use foul language on
right.
the radio,
but as you point out, it's about also having chosen, right, rather than maximizing our choices. And that, you know, modern psychology is discovering this, but this is what Augustine taught us, right? That freedom
right,
really comes
right.
from having chosen. And
right.
and yet I think we're attracted to, we are part of the glamour of evil is it makes us attracted to things that will actually maximize our choices. If I have just that much more money, I will have
right.
that many
right,
more choices,
right,
right. right? But it's actually from having chosen that we really find our true freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating article. The article is The Glamour of Evil by Gerald W. Schlabach. It was in the February 8th, 2016 issue of America. Dr. Schlabach, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you. I'm a longtime subscriber and regularly listen to the podcast, so it's a privilege to be on with you.
Fantastic. My favorite kind of person. Well, have a very blessed Lent.
Okay, you too.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to be talking with our editor-at-large, Father Jim Martin, about Ash Wednesday and the kind of paradoxical nature of it, particularly in its readings. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.